the Shabbos we were discussing the subject of Shmini. Now, Shmini, Parsha Shmini, Shmini means the eighth. So basically, it's talking about the eighth day. The eighth day of what? Actually, the events that are recorded at the beginning of the Parsha take place on the first day of Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which is the eighth day of the, so to speak, inauguration of the Mishkan. The Mishkan had been built, had been constructed, as we read, and then it was, so to speak, just using general terms over here, there were 7 days in which Moshe brought Karbanos. He erected the Mishkan every day, he brought Karbanos, and he took it down. And on the eighth day, that was after Aaron was designated to be the Kohen Gadol, him and his sons. At that time he had 4 sons. And the eighth day they brought the sacrifices, the inaugural sacrifices. But they didn't only bring inaugural sacrifices, which will, you know, come into the picture soon. And the particular segment that we're talking about. Okay, so that's Vayihi Yom HaShmini, was the eighth day of the period of inauguration. But this was the first time that Aaron and his sons were officiating, performing the Avodah, the service in the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? Now, as you know, you read the story, it begins with a tragedy that occurred. And that is that the 2 sons of Aaron died, or more than died, actually, their death was brought about from the Hashemayim, by God, because they were makriv, they brought a strange sacrifice. Alright, now we discussed this already, I'm not going into that tonight. There's a difference of opinion. The Torah is extremely cryptic. But if you think it's cryptic on this section, wait till we get to the section we're going to discuss tonight. And it just says that they brought a strange fire. Now the fire, of course, was part of the offering, the meal offering that they brought. So there's a difference of opinion as to what exactly the specific of the sin was. Did they bring it in the wrong place? They offered, or did they bring something that they weren't commanded? They offered it of their own accord. Apparently it means that they, but these were great men, they were great tzaddikim, but we discussed the significance of the avodah, the service in the Beit HaMikdash, is such that you can't deviate even to the slightest degree from the exact command. But in their own minds, they had this desire to bring this carbon. They thought it was okay. So some Chazal say that it was that's what they were punished for the decision that they made. It was an inappropriate decision. And the fact that they had this idea wasn't so big, but they should have consulted with Moshe. All right. Now, there is some proof. There is some support, let us say, for the position that the real sin was the inappropriate decision. Of course, then you go into the next parsha. The next parsha is where Moshe. And it's completely would seem to be out of context. Because it interrupts the story of what takes place on the eighth day for the parsha in which Moshe commands them not to drink wine, that it's prohibited to drink wine and then perform the avodah. Right? Now that's a perfect indication that this has something to do with what took place previously. Because then the Torah proceeds to go back to the description of what took place. So the story of the eighth day is not over yet. But after that sin, Moshe commands them not to drink any intoxicating beverages, and then do the avodah. So that's a very serious avera. He says openly that you incur the penalty of death if you do that. Do not drink intoxicating wine, you and your sons with you, when you come to the tent of meeting. When you come to the Beit HaMikdash, that you not die. This is an eternal decree for your generation. Alright? Now it mentions also that, of course, the reason is in order to distinguish between the sacred and the profane, and between the contaminated and the pure, but then it also says, and to teach the children of Israel all the decrees that Hashem had spoken to them through Moshe. From this we learn that Shikha Asalahoro, that the very same source, the same basis for the prohibition against doing the avodah and the Beit HaMikdash, also applies to a Rebbe or anyone, any teacher, to give tzach when he's drunk. This is that the bringing of the karbanos is a system of tremendous chachma and wisdom, and just like you have to be in the most appropriate state of mind in order to do the avodah, So too, in terms of pshat, you have to be in the most appropriate state of mind. Because the person knows that has to be on guard against certain of his own ideas, his own emotions, which might cause him to lean in one direction or a different direction, and he has to be able to put that aside and be completely faithful to the truth, objective. Okay. And then the text then picks up with the continuation of what takes place. And it describes something which is extremely strange. A very strange event occurs. One of the strangest events. Fascinating. I think one of the reasons I want to go into this is because, among other things, it demonstrates something which is extremely important, and that is, again and again, I defy anyone to say that the Torah, if you consider the Torah to be divine, it's a self-contained work, that God gave us the Torah, and we really have no need, no recourse to the oral law. That it's something that we can understand on our own. It's virtually impossible to figure out what's going on. We're going to read now Pasuk Yud Bey. Okay, so this picks up where the story left off. This is after the tragedy occurred, and Moshe consoled Aaron, and Aaron said that Aaron was silent. It seems that Aaron accepted the Gzar Din, the decree, but nevertheless, this is all that very same day. He did not leave the Beis HaMikdash. He continued the Avodah. I mean, that's something else which, you know, which would give us pause. You see the greatness, the level of greatness. This will illustrate the true level of greatness of the real Gedolim. And Aaron and his two sons continued with the Avodah, in spite of the fact that this great tragedy had just occurred. This is that Moshe said to Aaron and to Elazar and Isamar, because the other two sons, Nadav and Abihu, were no longer alive. Banav Hanosarim, his remaining sons, take the mincha, which remains from the burnt offerings of God, and eat it as matos. Okay, well, it can't be chametz, it has to be in the form of matos. This is a meal offering next to the altar, because it is kodesh kadashim, which is holy of holies. But it's to say that there are two levels of holy objects. I'm not going into these particulars right now, just you have to know in general. It's called kache kadashim, the most holy, and kache kalim, which are lesser, have a less degree of holiness, and different laws pertain to them, who can eat them, where they can be eaten, and so on and so forth. Now he commands them to eat it, v'achaltem, to eat it in the holy place, because this is your portion from the burnt offerings of God. For thus I have been commanded. What is the chiddush over here? What is the command? What have I did? What specific command is he referring to? We know that there are karbanos which are not to be consumed, which are totally consumed on the altar, and not just karbanola, but other karbanos you're permitted to eat from them. So it's not clear what he's getting at over here. What the point is, but this is extremely important. It's extremely important, and it'll come up later. Okay? Now, we could skip Pasuk 14 and 15, which is in general, giving general rules about who can eat and what you can eat, what portions, and so forth. Alright? That's a separate point. So let's fast forward. Let's continue now to after he gives these commands, telling them essentially to eat, but he told them to eat from the carbon, the sacrifice. One of the sacrifices, anyway, that they had just brought, and they eat the matzah. Now go to Pasuk 16. Then it says, "I'm just going to read the pasukim, and you tell me if you have any idea what's going on." And the he goat of the sin offering, darash Moshe. Moshe inquired very, very exceedingly inquired. Made great inquiries concerning it. So Moshe inquired about the ram, the goat rather, of the sin offering, and behold, it was burnt. And he got angry at Elazar and Isamar, b'nei Aaron Hanasarim, the remaining sons of Aaron, and said, he didn't just get angry, but he demanded, as Rashi explains, he demanded an explanation. This is the sense. Why did you not eat the chatas in the holy place? for it is Kodesh Kadashim, for it is of the higher degree of holiness. And that, and God has given you that in order to cause atonement, to bring about atonement for the congregation, to atone for you before God. Behold, its blood was not brought to the inner sanctuary. You should eat it in holiness, in the holy place, as I've commanded you. It's difficult to understand if Moshe gets angry. And we know that Moshe was the most humble, most respected person. And anger is the Rambam says, it's the worst nida that a person can have. You never get angry, but he gets angry. What did he get angry about? We have no idea what he got angry about. Then, let's continue though. And then Aaron said to Moshe, behold, this day they have brought the sin offering and the Ola before God, and things of this nature happen to me, and I will eat sin offering this day. Will it be good in the eyes of God? It says, and Moshe heard, and it was good in his eyes. Basically, we have three questions over here. Going back to Pasuk 12, it's not clear what Moshe instructed. Moshe gave instructions to Aaron and to Eleazar and Ithamar to eat of the mincha. That was the meal offering, which was flour. But then they ate it, they baked it in tomatoes because it couldn't be eaten of chametz. Alright? And he commands them to eat it, and that's in 13, Kichen Tuvesi, because that's what I commanded. So it's not clear what the chiddush is. What's so special about that? Alright? Now, the next thing we need to understand is what happens a few sentences later, where we're now in 16, where suddenly Moshe searches, seeks out information about the sin offering, the goat, the he-goat, and he discovers that it was burned. And he gets angry at Eleazar and Ithamar, the sons of Aaron, and rebuking them, why have you not eaten from the sin offering in the holy place, because it is holy of holies, therefore it has to be eaten in the holy place. And apparently it's necessary that God has commanded you to eat it in order to atone for the congregation, to bring about atonement for you and the congregation before God. Then in 18 he adds the word that, behold, its blood has not been brought to the inner sanctuary. What does that do then? Therefore you should eat it in the holy place as I have commanded. Now, where is he commanded? Is he referring to the command that he gave before? But that command that he gave before was a reference to the eating of the meal offering. Now we're talking about the animal offering. To understand what got Moshe angry, we don't understand his argument, nor do we understand the answer of Aaron, which solved the whole problem. Truth of the matter is, he wasn't even demanding an answer from Aaron, he was demanding an answer from Eleazar and Ithamar. Yet Aaron is the one who gives the answer. It all revolves around what we said before, that all this, the context, all this is happening on a day in which a big tragedy occurs. So you realize that Aaron was what we would call an Onim. We all know what an Onim is. That's the Aaron, not just Aaron, but also the two sons. Because that were their brothers. So you're in mourning for your brothers, and he was in mourning for his son. However, before burial, at that point in time, it's an Onim. He's in the status of being an Onim. Okay? Now, ordinarily, an ordinary Kohen cannot do the avodah, cannot do the service in the Beis HaMikdash if he's an Onim. Okay? However, Kohen Gadol, this is the principle, Kohen Gadol makriv on him. Now, Aharon had the status of being the Kohen Gadol, that's the chief Kohen. So he does the Avodah, even when he doesn't interrupt the Avodah, he continues with the Avodah, even while he's an owner. So therefore, everything fits over here. That is to say, if you follow what I'm saying, so Aaron could do the Avodah, but Elazar and Isamar could not do the Avodah, because they didn't have the status of being Kohen Gadol. They were what we call the term is Kohen Hedyot, an ordinary Kohen. Okay? The other thing you have to know is that nobody can eat from the Karbanos when they're even a Kohen Gadol. That is to say, Kohen Gadol does the Avodah, when he's in a makriv onim, he could do the Avodah, but he's not ochel. He can't eat the food when he's in a state of anima. Okay? On this day, there were two different categories of sacrifices that were brought. And they fall into two headings. One heading is called kachei sha'a. That is to say, sacrifices with, for the time, that was just for that day. But they were not to be duplicated. Okay? They were brought, specifically the purpose was for the inauguration, the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash. This is the eighth day. This is the day on which the Beis HaMikdash was dedicated. The first day in which, you know, Aaron and his sons performed the Avodah. So, there were two such karbanos that are being referred to over here. And they are, that one was the carbon of Nachshon and Aminadab, because each one of the leaders of the tribe had to bring a specific carbon on behalf of his Sheva, on behalf of his tribe. So Nachshon was the first, because he was the head of the tribe of Yehuda. Okay, so that's one. And that Kachei Shah, that was not to be duplicated, that was a one-time thing. And there was also the carbon for the inauguration, for the entire tzibur. But two of the carbonas that we're talking about were specific to that time and were not permanent carbonas. However, they also brought, since it was on what day did this occur, Shmini was really the first day of Nisan, which was Rosh Chodesh, so there was a special carbon for Rosh Chodesh. Every Rosh Chodesh had to bring a carbon. So that was not Kachei Shah, that was Kachei Doro. That was for the generations. It said this is the first time they'll bring you, but it wasn't because of this particular time that was going to be a permanent one. You see? Which was a Mechaper. And that was Mechaper, that's referred to over here as Mechaper. Because that was an atonement for any type of an Avera in terms of defiling the Beis HaMikdash. That's what the carbon of Rosh Chodesh was a atonement for. They're very specific, all different types of karbanos, atoning for different types of sins. That is to say, for being metame, for causing defilement, or for entering in a state of defilement. Okay? So that karbon on Rosh Chodesh was a permanent one. Pasuk 12, Moshe commands Aaron and Elazar and Isamar, the remaining sons, to take the mincha, the meal offering, from the karbon. This is now a reference to the meal offering of the kachei shah, the specific karbanos that were brought just for that time, the inaugural one, and which would not be duplicated, and to eat it as matos by the mizbeach, and go to Pasuk Gimel now. He ends this entire discussion where they're supposed to eat it, and that's their portion, and so forth. Kichein tuvesi, for thus I have been commanded. Now we understand why Moshe had to command them, because this was a very big chiddush. Because normally the rule is that a kohen cannot eat. He said even a kohen gadol cannot eat the karbon when he is in a state of being an onen. So Moshe was saying that that does not apply. I got a special command from Kichein Tuvesi. Thus I have been commanded that on this day there's an exemption to that rule. Right? There's an exemption to that rule, and you're supposed to eat it even though you're in a state of aninus. Kichein Tuvesi. That's the command. But the halacha is, the general halacha is that a kohen cannot eat from the karban when he's in a state of anemia. Okay? That's the basis. Moshe, therefore, is the one who received the command from God, which apparently, you know, this will lead us into the discussion which takes place. Because what we encounter next is a very fascinating phenomenon. What you encounter is really, what would we call it in Talmudic terms? A machlokas. You all know the argument doesn't really, you know, convey what a machlokas. You have really a halachic machlokas between Moshe and Aaron. That's what takes place. This is the first instance of a Talmudic halachic machlokas. And you see, even though Moshe Rabbeinu, and it's interesting, many things can be learned from this. But even though Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest Torah authority, and he was talking about a specific law that he had received from God, it did not prevent Aaron from disagreeing. This is something which we have to remember, because in today's society, everything is authority, and it's automatically assumed that if you say something and it makes perfect sense, whatever, but if somebody who's bigger than you said differently, that's automatically assumed that you can't be right. Which is not necessarily the case. Of course, we have a system of authorities. I'm saying, not to the point that you can't disagree, or that your idea can't be the correct one. You see, it's a system where it's based upon logic, it's reason, it's ideas, and as a general rule, of course, the greater authority, I mean, obviously, in general, will be more accurate, but that doesn't mean that in every particular case, just because he's greater, that his idea is true. There's no such thing as infallibility. You see, there's no such thing as infallibility. This is a perfect example. And that's another thing which it may sound very elementary, but in this day and age, it's important to remember that. The way certain people regard their rebbes or whatever, the rebbe said, that's it. Whether it's true, whether it makes sense, doesn't make sense, as though this thing is infallibility. It's not the case. You see, here's Moshe Rabbeinu. Many people erroneously think that machlokas is something which developed historically as a result of confusion, the travail, so to speak, of the exile, persecution. So, it's unfortunate that all the students weren't gathered together, so, differences of opinion and so forth. I'm not saying that is a factor, but the truth of the matter is that machlokas is something which is integral to the whole process of Torah. So you see, it's in the Torah itself you find the case of a machlokas. In the nature of what Torah study is all about, since it's a system of ideas and it's given over to the human mind, of course, the person has to be trained, he has to be on the highest level of understanding, but there are different minds and different opinions, but valid. Not everything, a valid difference of opinion with regard to the formulation of a halachic principle is part of the Torah itself. You understand? You see that from this case. Now, what takes place is as follows. Moshe then inquired about that the Seir HaChatos. Okay? Now, the Chachamim, the rabbis who were analyzing the whole situation, came to the conclusion which carbon was he talking about over here? Which one? It could not be the two that I mentioned that were specific to that day. Well, he's talking about Rosh Chodesh. And that's why that's referred to as the atonement. Because that was designed to bring atonement, as I said to you before, for any sin of defilement of the Migdash. That fits in there. That Moshe inquired about the Seir HaChatos, which was the carbon which was brought for Rosh Chodesh. Okay? And that was Kachei Doros. That was for all the generations. And he discovered that it was burned. And he got extremely angry. Which means, when he discovered it was burned, means that it hadn't been eaten. And he had just given instructions about the fact that it was supposed to be eaten. Because the eating of the carbon, any carbon which requires eating, so if it's not eaten, so then it wasn't done properly, so it doesn't provide an atonement. That's why I got angry. That you made a serious mistake over here with regard to the order of the karbana. That's Madu Alo Achaltan. Why didn't you why didn't you eat from the chatas in the holy place? Because it is holy of holies. And that has been given to you, lasteis esavona eda, to atone, to make amends for the sin of the congregation, to bring atonement for you before God. So that's why this is a very serious thing. And if you don't do it correctly, you don't eat from those karbanos that require eating, so then it doesn't provide the atonement. Now, behold, his blood was not brought to the inner sanctuary. That's something you'd never understand on your own. Like, you need to know the halacha over here. Because take a look at Rashi. If you have Rashi, Rashi provides an explanation. See, Rashi adds a lot of the missing elements to the dialogue. The pasuk doesn't contain the entire dialogue. Heinlo, let's go to Yudches, for example. Heinlo huva, behold, its blood was not brought. She'ilu huva, because if it was brought, that is to say that there are many things that can disqualify a karban. Now, one of those things is if the blood is sprinkled on the wrong place. This was supposed to be sprinkled on the outer altar. If instead they made a mistake and brought it into the inner altar and sprinkled it over there, so then it would be disqualified and you wouldn't be allowed to eat it. So the Rosh saying, hey, lo huva, that's not the case. It didn't happen. For if it did happen, if it was brought them, then hayalachem l'sarfa, then you should have burnt it. Then I had no problem. As, and he quotes the pasuk, vayikra vav, any chatas when the blood is brought, etc., etc. Okay? So then, he says, if that's the case, in other words, he was inquiring if there was any justification, some kind of mistake had been made, you couldn't eat it, okay, but nothing, everything was done appropriately. If everything was done appropriately, achol tochlo, so you're supposed to eat it. Kasher tivesi, as I have commanded. Oh, because he anticipates what your problem is. You probably didn't eat it because you're in a state of aninus. And the halacha is that you're not allowed to eat in a state of aninus. But I just commanded Kasher Tivesi that this is an exception. That's what Rashi says. Achol tofu osa. Hayalacham la'achla. You were supposed to eat it. Afa pishatem oninim. Even though you're in a state of aninus. Kasher Tivesi lacham b'mincha. Just like I commanded you with the mincha. Of course, you might wonder, why did Moshe address himself to Elazar and Yisamar, not to Aaron? All three of them were implicated. Rashi gets into that, and I'm just going to touch on it very lightly. Everything here was done derech kavod. So you see that this is a different kind of an anger. It's not like he lost his cool. But it means to say that he demonstrated this is a very serious thing. But nevertheless, out of kavod for Aaron, in front of the sons, he didn't want to rebuke. He didn't want to come across as rebuking Aaron. He addressed it to the sons, out of respect for Aaron. And the sons did not respond, even though they knew the answer, because they didn't want to pass the halacha in front of their father. So they showed kavod to their father. Everything here was done derech kavod. That's something you wouldn't really pick up. But Rashi points that out. So you see, sorry? There's many, many ideas to learn over here. I'm skimming through them because I want to get to the main point. But if you study it carefully, these nuances, you see how they contain all these important ideas. What's the answer of Aaron? Take a look at that. Vayedaber, and Aaron said to Moshe, Behold this day, they brought the sin offering and the Olah before God. This is a very, very difficult, very cryptic question. And these things occurred to me, things of this nature occurred to me. We don't know what he's talking about. And I will eat sin offering this day. Will it be good in the eyes of God? I mean, it seems like a bunch of disjointed statements. Okay. So Rashi says as follows. Heinayom ikrivu is a response. You have to assume the Torah is not capturing all of the dialogue, just the main point. Now this is a response. Rashi says, Heinayom ikrivu, when he says, behold this day. It's a question. He's answering. Rashi says, what is he saying? But Moshe said to him, Moshe said, well, perhaps you sprinkled the blood in a state of aninus. Okay? Now remember what I told you before. That is to say that only the Kohen is permitted to do the Avodah. Kohen Gadol Makrivonim. But Elazar and his son were not permitted to do any of the Avodah. Because Kohen Hedger is not Makrivonim. So he's saying, as a question, that Moshe said, well, maybe you're not eating it because perhaps they participated in the Avodah. Elo Amar Lahem, what Moshe said, perhaps you sprinkled the blood in the state of Aninus. And an Onain who did the Avodah has defiled it. Amar Lo Aaron, Aaron said to him, V'chihem Mikrivu? It's intended as a question. V'chihem Mikrivu? Did they? He said he's denying that. No, what Aaron's trying to point out to him is that all the points that you've made, that as reasons why it hasn't been eaten, in other words, Moshe was focusing, the only thing he can consider, can think of, is that perhaps it's been defiled, and therefore it can't be eaten, that's why you burned it. And Aaron's saying no. The Chihemik Rivu, did they bring it? Shehem Ed Yotas? They are ordinary Kohanim? Ani Yikrafti, took full responsibility. I brought it, and therefore it was not, there was no problem of it, and I'm a Kohen Gadol, and I am permitted to be Makriv Onin, and therefore there's absolutely no problem. But then he says, so that's the beginning. First he is very, very, the main theme of it is honesty, he's very honest. Any other reason, the fact that perhaps it was sprinkled in the wrong place, or perhaps it was sprinkled by the wrong people, which would therefore defile it, none of that occurred. But what did occur? Vatikrena osi ka'ela. That's a very strange expression. Like these things, ka'ela. Things of this nature occurred to me. When it says about tikrena, means it occurred to me, it happened to me. This event, ka'ela, like this. Meaning like the death of my son. But he doesn't say this, he says like this. Meaning, because he's talking in not just this particular case, because he didn't want you to get the idea that it's just sons, any of the relatives that you'd have to mourn for. You see? He's expanding the principle. Ka'ela would mean anything like this. That what you see? What happened to me is really a case of a death. It's true, my two sons, but the same would be cut like any of close relatives. Okay? Vatikren osi ka'ela. V'yachalti chatas hayom? And you expect me, and should I eat chatas in a state of aninus? Hayita, would that be good in the eyes of God? I mean, that's the halacha. The halacha is kohen gadol makriv onein, but ain't no ochel onein. So you have a machlokes. Because Moshe Rabbeinu knew that halacha as well. But Moshe kasheti vesi. This is different. This is different. I got the halacha from God. Moshe received the halacha. And he, interestingly, everybody would say, well, Moshe receives from God. He's got to be right. I'm saying no. There's an argument. What is the argument, though? See, the principle, God did not give all the particulars, all the details. And it's a system. God gives us the general ideas, the principles, but all the deductions and so on and so forth, that's left to the expert. Now, in this particular case, the command which Moshe conveyed to them to eat from the mincha, the meal offering, which carbon was that? That was the carbon which was brought to the dedication. So therefore that was kachei shah. That was only specific to that moment. It wasn't kachei dorah. That they all agreed. That's what he said, kachei shivesh. You see? Now, the question then is, this principle can be interpreted, lends itself to two different interpretations. Does that mean to say that it's a din, that law, the suspension of the principle, that you can't eat in a state of aninus, that it was suspended for that day, wasn't applicable to the entire day? Okay? And then it would come into effect later. Okay? Or no, that was a din, so to speak, a principle in that particular carbon. That particular carbon was kachesha, you see? But the other one was Kachei Dara. And Kachei Dara didn't apply to. Those are two logical possibilities. Okay? Now Moshe thought one way. Moshe thought that by virtue of the same principle that enabled them to eat of the Kachei Shah, of this specific one, so that meant that the way he understood it was that it was a general suspension, that the Kohanim were exempt. It was a din in the Kohen, that on that day the Kohen was completely exempt from that whole prohibition. That prohibition did not apply to the Kohen. Mm-hmm. Normally a Kohen has the prohibition of eating in that state, you see, but it meant to say that God suspended the principle completely from the Kohen. So if that's the case, any carbon that comes about, you should eat. That's why he inquired about the Erachatas. It's true that that's Kachei Doros, but what's the difference? If the concept is that the prohibition has been suspended for the day, so then you should eat this as well. That's why you got angry. Right. And if the halacha is that you have to eat, then it's not going to provide Nitzolim unless you do eat. Mm-hmm. So that's why you got angry at them. You got into all these things. Why didn't you eat it? So then, Elah ben Aaron, what he responded, very respectfully, that I don't, that's not the correct principle. That's not the way I understand it. And he says, and he made it very clear. Nothing, everything was done properly. I did the avoda, they didn't do the avoda. But vatikrena osika elu. I'm in a state of aninus. So yes, it is true. We did eat from that carbon, but that's because the exemption was attached to that particular. But it's not a universal. It's not a universal dispensation removing us completely from the prohibition altogether. This is Kachei Doros. Kachei Doros has nothing to do with this particular day. It's just accidental that it has to be brought on this day. So Moshe heard. He liked it. And of course, I didn't want to make the point about Machlokas, that the Torah by its very nature demands use of the mind. And you see, by the way, you see that a great person is one who does not simply cave in to someone else who happens to be superior, but you never give up your own mind. Because Aaron recognized Moshe as being superior, no question about it. But that does not mean to say that you're obligated to give up your own mind and just to blindly follow the opinion of somebody else who's superior. By the way, I'm learning Sanhedrin right now. Sanhedrin of 23 in capital cases. And so they go around. And the principle is, when they go on, they ask each person for his decision. And they would begin from the smallest and go work their way up. And normally, not respectfully, you start from the guddle. Here you start from the smallest. What's the reason? The reason is because the concern is that once the great would give his opinion, the others would sort of be intimidated. And then, even though they disagreed, they would sort of renounce their own. They say, how can I do this? He must be. And if a person does that, it's a biblical violation. A dayan that does not state what he truthfully considers to be the halacha, because he's overawed by someone greater, that's an issur d'oraisa. He's obligated to give his own opinion. It's assuming that he's thought it through, and according to his own mind, that's the truth, that's the opinion he has to give. And there's no, we don't have this concept, because if a person has the training, he has the principles and knowledge, that's his day, or it could be that his one is correct. We don't automatically assume that the truth always goes by the person who's higher. The Issur d'oraisa, by the way, is correct, as the Nomi thing, in any case. Any Dayan, in any case, it doesn't have to be a capital case, any case before them, if he renounces his opinion in favor of someone else's opinion purely out of, I mean, if he hears the opinion and he changed, he logically sees his mistake, and now that becomes his. That's different, of course. But if in his own mind he doesn't really see it, he's afraid. You know, who am I to argue with Rav Moshe? That's it. No, his job is to state the truth as he sees it. So from this you see, in my opinion, the true greatness, of course, of Aaron, the real nature of what Torah is all about, the true study of Torah, and that is that each person has to use his mind to the greatest ability, and he has to have confidence in his own opinion. But there's one thing over here that I think is very important to stress. And that is the greatness of Moshe. The anivus, the real humility, the humbleness of Moshe Rabbeinu. I think this story depicts it more than any other story. In that, put yourself in that situation. This is the real idea of anivus. Anivus really is essential. Why is it so important? Because the most important thing in Yadus is for a person to know the truth.
Yeah.
Let's see, of course, this is what affects him. This is what brings him closer to God. And the greatest obstacle that stands in the way of MS is a person's attachment to his own ego, and specifically, the inability of a person to be moda ala MS, to admit to the truth. And you see, mostly, you see the arguments on TV, debates, whatever. And sometimes you'll watch, and you'll see how assume intelligent people and whatever, knowledgeable in their field, they enter debate. Did you ever see a case, a debate is supposed to try and clarify that. Okay. You ever see a case where it's not as clear, this person has just been refuted. The person makes an assertion, a thesis, and that the other person knocks it down clearly, boom, 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 totally, and in your own mind, that's it. And then you'd expect the other person, okay, you know, no, he just comes back, twists, turns, spins. You ever see a case where after the debate, people say, no, I came here thinking such and such, I heard you, are you really right? Never. No matter what. Now, tragically, you find that very, to a large degree in the Jewish world as well. That's why we have so many different arguments and up and back and every side. I've never seen a case, I mean, I read the two, you know, you'll see two sides, pro, con, whatever, these major issues. And, alright, sometimes it may not be that clear. This one's a little bit better than the other one. But sometimes it's very, very clear that these arguments have been refuted. Now, why didn't the other person write back and say, I can see? Never, ever. They just turn, twist, find another thing, evasion. So that capacity, of course, everybody speaks about truth. And, but the test, and this person maybe have many good ideas, which are true ideas. That's not the real test. The real test of a person's dedication to truth is when he stated something, and this is something that is very important. It's his point, it's his idea, and he argues, you know, like you argue the point, you have a right to argue your point. But then, after thinking it over, and he sees that he's been refuted, he's able to give up his point, to be moda ala emes, and admit that the other person is correct. I would say that there are, in this particular case, bear in mind, Aaron did not just prove Moshe. Did he bring any proof, Aaron? He didn't have any proof. Why did Moshe just concede? Yeah. Aaron just gave the other side. There were two logical possibilities over here. Both of them make sense. Both of them. Did Aaron bring any riots that he had, that this is the way it has to be, as opposed to the other side? No. I just want to say, there are three situations, three possible situations. One case, and there were three different degrees of imperfection or perfection. There's one case where you stated your point. You know, you've gotten up and you've given an explanation in front of a group in the class. Then somebody gets up. Well, as a teacher, I'll have this experience. You know, he asks very good questions, contradicting what you're saying. There's one case where, in other words, the greatest degree of imperfection would be where you thought that this was correct and you've been really refuted. I mean, the fact clearly it's impossible. I mean, you're refuted. And yet you will see there are people that in a situation like that they'll concede. I'm saying from my experience I'm very surprised because I've seen cases where they should concede and they'll twist it and twist and turn. A lawyer. But that would be the greatest imperfection in this area where in spite of the evidence against you, you still persist. You don't care. I don't care. What the fact this is it. My point is that the first level is where your point has been refuted. To be, if a person isn't on that level, I think he's really complete. That's a serious corruption. Now, the second level that I'm talking about, the way I've worked it out, to work it out in different ways, is where you have not been absolutely refuted. But it's pretty clear which, you know, the other side, the arguments are better on the other side. It makes more sense. It's more mistaken, as we say. It's much more, it makes much more sense. However, you can hide behind the fact that, see, in the first case, in order to defend yourself, you really have to, like, just deny reality. In this case, since it's not absolute, you can twist and turn, you can get out of it, it's true. And I'll say to a person, listen, I can't prove that you're wrong. I don't have any absolute breakdown. But my just overall sense and understanding of the subject, your arguments are pretty weak. No, I mean, that requires a greater degree of perfection. That a person, even though he has not been completely refuted, but he's able to give up his idea on the basis of the fact that the other one makes more sense. In other words, it's easier for him to defend himself if he wants to, but he doesn't defend himself because he sees the greater persuasiveness of the other side. Okay. It's not so bad to make a mistake. People shouldn't be so upset. Sometimes people are too intimidated to think because they're afraid they'll be wrong. Nothing to make a mistake. That's not the tragedy. The tragedy is when you get so attached to your position, and this is not just in thinking in life itself. How many people since they can't admit they made a mistake, now you're forced into destroying your mind. Because now you have to distort reality and twist things around. That's the real damage of the mind. The damage is not in making the mistake. You learn from mistakes. But if you can't acknowledge the mistake, then the real damage begins. Then you become a spin doctor and you have to twist reality. Then your whole sense of reality is destroyed. By the way, it's true in many areas of life. I mean, how many people suffer years in relationships, this and that, because they can't admit they made a mistake and they were wrong. And, correct it now, but no, they have to keep denying and live in denial and changing and smiling. Maybe it'll be this way, denying reality. What's the problem? I maintain the third level is what we're talking about over here in the case of Moshe, and Moshe represents the ultimate imperfection, that anav miyod, that he was motivated by one thing alone, purely an absolute love of the truth. And there was no element of egotism in his search. Because over here, it wasn't even like the second case, where the other side has better arguments, even though they're not absolute. Here, Aaron did not bring any proof whatsoever. It wasn't that there was debate. He, and his position, everybody would have, found better, even though he couldn't absolutely prove it. Moshe didn't have to concede at all. It says Vayitav. He liked it. He liked it. It means to say is that you can maintain, objectively speaking, my position is just as strong as yours. But in terms of my love of knowledge, of thinking, as I think it, in my own mind, it was purely in the mind of Moshe that he thought over his position, and then he thought over Aaron's position. And he liked it better. It was smoother. We don't know why. We don't really know why. He decided it could go either way. It meant purely in terms of his love of truth and his appreciation. He heard. He was able to listen to the other person's idea. That's what the Torah says. Vayishma Moshe. That's the ability to listen to somebody else's idea in spite of the fact that you know that he has no way of disproving your idea. By Yishma, to take the idea seriously, that's a love of truth. That means the fact that you have your own view and it's a formulated view and it's an acceptable view and you presented it and now you hear the other view and there's not, and everybody agrees that both are, we can't prove one over the other, and let me listen to that. You listen to it and your decision is based purely on your sense of reality and your sense of truth. Vayitav, and he liked it, and he admitted it, that's the ultimate thing. See? Now, the lesson here is talking about the formulation of the Mishnah, the basic principles, and so forth, but he's discussing many other topics that are extremely important. Over here he says, he's explaining why, when Rebbe wrote the Mishnah, so why did he record the argument? The Talmud says this with the Talmud that one is to record the psak. We usually go like Beis Hillel. All right. Listen, there is a reason for recording the opinion of one man, though he later withdrew from that opinion. even in a case where he later changed his mind. Excuse me. One sees this, for example, when the sage is stated, quote, Beishame says such and such, whereas Beis Hillel says such and such. And Beis Hillel reconsidered and taught according to the opinion of Beishame. Sometimes love it. So what do I have to know? Why don't you simply say what the halacha is? What interest is that to me? To demonstrate their love for the truth and that righteousness and honesty prevail. Not just honesty, but that's what righteousness is. A righteous person is someone who always lives in accordance with the truth. Thus, when these honored, pious, noble people of eminent scholarship saw that the opinions of him who argues with them are better than their own, and that his deliberations are correct, they would admit to him and change to his viewpoint. That's what he's talking about. Not talking about how great, that they were great thinkers. We know that they were great thinkers. Not that they had the ability to arrive at the truth. We know that. But we also know that every individual makes mistakes. That the greatest thinker is not infallible and he makes mistakes. So what's even more important than the ability to think correctly if you want the truth is the ability to acknowledge a mistake. That's righteousness. See? And evil is the inability to acknowledge that you're wrong. People that can't admit that they were wrong, that's a very serious moral defect. That's amazing. I mean, it's not just in study in human relationships, all the grudges, all the fightings that go on and everything, because of distortion. Because a person can't be honest, think it through, look at it from the angle of the other person. You're just looking at it from your own narrow viewpoint, and yeah, I can see it, even though it goes against your emotions, no, but it's true, I can see that thing. All the more so should other people, when seeing the truth, lean toward their opponents, likewise turn to this truth, and accept it without being stubborn. Stubborn is what he's talking about. This is the meaning of the scriptural phrase, justice, justice, shalt thou fear. Tzedek, tzedek, tzedek. That's why it's repeated. Justice, justice. So apparently there's two. There's justice, you should pursue justice. Initially you should think, and this is my, he doesn't explain any more than that, but this is my interpretation of justice, justice. Of course, initially you should be honest, put aside your emotions, think clearly, come to conclusion. That's one justice. But then after somebody else breaks it down and points out a flaw, now it becomes a question of whether you're going to be stubborn and just stick to your own view, or be able to acknowledge that that's justice, justice. That's the real justice. And that's the real pursuit of truth. It is concerning this matter that the sages stated, acknowledge the truth. And these are things that sound very simple. I know, it sounds very simple. This is your whole life. This is your whole life. There's two different lives. There's a life of a person that can't acknowledge the truth and he doesn't make any growth whatsoever. He just keeps evolving and evolving. The same basic ideas he had when he was 10, they've just been updated, but he's 20, it's just another way of expressing it. He can't grow because he's stubborn. Because he can't acknowledge the truth. Now listen to this one. I'm coming to the part, this is the reason why I cited it. This quotation. Meaning, you ever find yourself in this situation? Even if you could save face with sophisticated counter-arguments, as a teacher, by the way, I mean, this is a personal method. Very often a student will raise questions, and the student is not really strong enough to back it up and break it down, and you really can convince the student. You can really break, you can convince him that really believe that his point was off and that your point is correct. But in your own mind, he's got you. You see, but you have the power now. You're in a situation that could be in an argument discussion with a friend. And they've really hit something, and you know they've hit something, but you have you've learned how to think, you've learned how to argue, you have the ability to break them down. How many people are going to forego that ability to break them down? That's what he says. Even if you could save face with sophisticated counter-arguments, if you know that your friend's viewpoint is the correct one, although your argument may be clearer due to his weakness in expressing himself. So you're in a situation where you've got the bad card, but you know how to play it better. Let's put it that way. Right. Okay? Well, because of your ability to pervert the truth, withdraw to his viewpoint and abandon the fight. That's the ultimate. Where you're in the arena, in the situation, you have all the cards. You have the ability to counter his arguments and to prove convincingly to everybody that your position is correct. But in your own mind, you know that it's false. That's the truth. That's the ultimate test. See? That's the ultimate test of greatness. And of course, this is the lesson of Moshe Rabbeinu. That Moshe Rabbeinu was happy. Even if we just read by Yitzchok, he was angry. Which meant that in his mind at that point in time, this was a very serious error. Now, we had mentioned that before. Because it's one thing to disagree, and then have to back down. But you know, but as it gets on and on, and I'm very vehement about the point, that's impossible. Can't be. And you know, you really, by itself, you get angry. And then now you're really totally committed to that point of view. Then it's very difficult to move away from it. No, by itself, because at that point in time, that was the truth. It wasn't because it was his idea. It was because to him it was the truth. If it was the truth, then how can you do this? But once he heard by Yishma, he wasn't disproven. He had no need. There was no necessity. Even according to halacha, there were two valid viewpoints. But and he had heard it from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He got the principle from God, and he gave it over to them, and they defined what he heard, how it should be. By Yishma, you're right. By Yitav Vienu, that is the ultimate. That's what we all should strive for, and that's the role model of what a Rebbe should really be. Someone who has the capacity to listen to what the student has to say, to think it over very carefully. And by the way, of course, that's the most enriching experience. I mean, I've gained tremendously from my students. The truth of the matter is like this. When you develop this ability, you don't really gain. You really enjoy learning. Because it's no longer a battle at protecting your ego and worrying who got the idea. And then you see how you're closed off. With this attitude, you can't enrich yourself from other people's ideas, because by doing so, you're admitting he's right and I'm wrong. You can't do that, so therefore you're losing out. Once you have this capacity, you have the ability to hear what people say. And you'd be surprised, even if you don't accept it completely, but it's an opening, it's a new way. That's the amazing thing I've learned over the years of being a Rebbe and using this method, how much I can learn from different students, different input, even if I didn't accept the idea in its entirety, but it opened up a window. That is what this is all about. Because Yad is ultimately all of the virtues that we're talking about, and especially Anivus, which is the greatest of the virtues, you see, it's for your own perfection, because ultimately it's the ability to partake of the truth that God has given to us. That's the real good. And that's what this story is all about.